Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens by TheAthletic.com. I am Marc-Antoine Godin, alongside Arpin Basu on this beautiful Wednesday, May 18. Hello, my friend. How are you today?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
Yeah. Excited with the upcoming draft. I know it's still ways away, but we've got the Combine coming up in not too long, so that's something to look forward to.
Love Buffalo in June. Love it.
Yes, I know.
Looking forward.
Plenty of nice restaurants, plenty of good tables over there. So if people have a negative prejudice towards Buffalo, it's because either you're not a foodie or you're a snob.
or you've never been there, frankly. I quite enjoy Buffalo and it gets a bad rap for no reason. I don't understand why.
No doubt about it. Yeah. And even on the hockey side, they've got a bad rap, but I got a sense that the Sabres are about to turn it around. But that's for another day and maybe even for another podcast and not The Athletic Support. So, because today we're going to dive headfirst on the upcoming draft. And we've got the great pleasure to welcome on the show today, Scott Wheeler, our resident prospects expert at The Athletic. So Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And just listening to you guys off the top there, I must admit, I used to be a Buffalo snob, and I am a convert at this point. It has been great getting to know that city a little bit over the last several years, ever since the Combine switched from Toronto to Buffalo. I think that has been a very good thing for the Combine. So, no, Buffalo, you're absolutely right. An underrated sort of city, especially on the food side of things.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And I think it gets a bad rap because it can be pretty grim in the winter. Like, I mean, it's the whole lake effect thing and like these massive snowstorms and whatever, but it's really, I quite enjoy it. And there are a lot of good meals to be had in Buffalo, and the vibe around the combine is always fun. The weather's nice. You know, there's all this excitement and all these prospects who are on the verge of this life-changing moment. And so there's, you know, optimism and all sorts of things that you don't necessarily associate with Buffalo and hockey apply at the combine. And so that's another nice thing, you know, is that there is a sort of a happiness of the whole thing to the whole thing.
Even for the scouts too, a lot of the stress is gone. They've done their final meetings. I mean, it's still a work week. They still have jobs to do, and those schedules are busy when they get into their interview schedules with the players and sort of cranking them out one after another. But even on their side, it feels like once everybody from the hockey world gathers there, it's kind of more of a crossing your T's and dotting your I's thing than a super stressful week for them. So you get everybody at ease a little bit.
Yeah. So the combine takes place first week of June this season. And let's start with that. What's you mentioned the fact that the scouts pretty much know what their list is going to look like. They've got their opinion set, but how much does this move the needle, that event?
It does matter. I hear stories every year about dinners gone wrong and players who leave the wrong impression and that kind of a thing. So it does matter. If you've got a fierce debate happening from one player to the next, especially for the teams at the top who actually have a good sense of who they're drafting, the teams at the bottom, you're collecting a group of five or six guys and hoping that two of them are available and then you have a choice to make, right? The teams at the top have a much better sense for who their guy or two guys might be. So then it does become a little bit more important for them as they sort of really look to get some of those guys into one-on-one settings, and they take them out for dinner, and all of that tends to take place. And that can move the needle a little bit. The fitness testing really only matters for the guys, I think, that perform at the very top and the very bottom. I don't think teams read too much into the middle of the pack, but if a kid really crushes it or a kid really struggles, that can be something that raises eyebrows. So there's a little bit of that. That happens as well in Kitchener. This year in Kitchener, at least for the CHL Top Prospects game, you do start to hear people talk about the David Goyettes and the Vincennes Rowers, the kids who performed really well and really surprised some people with how well they performed in both the on-ice and off-ice testing in Kitchener for the CHL Top Prospects game. So there's a little bit of that with this combine as well, just kids that really step up and impress. But by and large, it's just a weekend to get everybody together, to get the kids talking, to get the kids loose, and to really figure out whether player X or player Y is your guy. So I don't think it's a huge determining factor for a lot of the kids, but there are real takeaways that come out of it for the NHL teams.
Yeah, and when you mentioned teams at the top of the draft, you know, a year like this one where there is not an unquestioned, undebated number one top prospect, for the teams at the top of the draft, the interview process might carry a bit more weight than usual this year, I would think, just in the sense that, you know, on the ice, you know, maybe they're left unconvinced by any of the top guys, you know, Shane Wright or Slavkovsky or Cooley or what have you. You know, in that sense, maybe the interview can be a real difference maker for them in terms of just, you know, and all the psychological profile that goes on and all the personality profiling and all that stuff that might be more significant this year than most years, I would think.
Definitely. This isn't a Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews draft. I've got a book coming out in the fall on sort of behind the scenes with the Leafs at the NHL draft. And as part of that, learned about the process that the Leafs and Brendan Shanahan in particular went through with Austin Matthews. And in that draft class, sure, they talked to Patrick Laine and they did their homework on Patrick Laine and did their due diligence and spent 2 months digging into him. But at the end of the day, they knew that there was a very small chance that anything that they found in their digging on Austin Matthews and Patrick Laine was going to change their mind. And that just doesn't exist in this draft class. It is incumbent on Montreal to make sure that no stone is left unturned, right? They need to do their due diligence on the three big forwards on Wright, on Cooley, on Slafkovsky, and they need to do their due diligence, frankly, as well on the two big defensemen, I would probably argue, in Simon Nemitz and David Juracek. So that's really five guys. And maybe it's just Shane at the end of the day, and he's your guy, and he's the big name and the kid with all the notoriety and the kid we've been hearing about for years, and maybe he ends up being the guy. I think that's still the most likely outcome. But those four or five kids absolutely deserve their full attention. So I expect it'll be a busier week for them than maybe it was for Edmonton with Connor McDavid or the Leafs with Austin Matthews, right?
You've dealt with Shane Wright in the past, and you were mentioning how at the combine, you know, it's obviously, as everybody knows, it's the interview process with those top prospects. I'd be curious to hear you about more about Shane Wright's personality. I know that the other day on TSN, there was an interview where he said that he thought he deserved to be the number one pick, and that he basically, it suggests that he said it in a way that rubbed some people the wrong way, as if there was a certain level of entitlement, as though it he's, you know, more than he earned it, but it should belong to him. And you could confuse, you know, just a guy being very confident in his attributes and his qualities as a hockey player with a bit of, you know, yeah, as I said, a bit of entitlement. So what sort of a kid is he in terms of his mentality, his makeup? And for those who might have been concerned with hearing things like that, is there any source of concerned on that matter?
Yeah, so I've got to know Shane really well over the last several years. I've done two big stories on him. One, when he was in minor hockey with the Don Mills Flyers, I spent a lot of time with him that year and got to know his family and sort of told the story of this exceptional status player at the time. And then I wrote a second story last year that actually almost took Shane and his family and the sort of personal background out of it, and just talk to people around him, people in Kingston, people with Hockey Canada, scouts, et cetera, about, okay, who is this kid and this player that everybody's so excited about? And that was obviously at the time when he was not playing hockey into his very first World Junior camp a year and a half ago now. So those two stories are still a little bit distant. I haven't written a similar feature this year, but have gotten to know him through the work that he does in Toronto in the summer here. I attend every year the sort of skating sessions that he participates in and around the city with Nick Quinn and his group. So have got to know him through that and his strength coach and all of that. And the impression I've got from everybody around him, strength coach, skills coach, parents, coaches in Kingston with Don Mills, his agent, Cam Stewart, is that this is a tremendous, tremendous kid. And it's harder to get, I'll be honest, it's harder to get that impression talking to him face to face and one-on-one. I find he's actually pretty guarded. And I was a little bit surprised by that interview with TSN, not because I haven't heard that he's not a confident kid. By all accounts, he is a very sure of himself, confident in who he is kid. He's been doing this for a long time. He's been in the limelight for a long time. He's done dozens and dozens of interviews. But my impression of him has been that he's a little bit hard. He's a little bit tricky, actually, to get to know and to truly understand. I think he has tried to lighten that a little bit this year. I think that was part of what showing his confidence was. It was about presenting himself maybe a little bit differently than he has in the past. I think that's why he's been talking about some of his hobbies and some of the things he's into, like picking up guitar this year and other things that he's mentioned in several interviews now. But he's definitely a hockey player and a top hockey player. He kind of reminds of John Tavares and Connor McDavid at the same age, where it can be a little tricky to sort of crack that nut, if you will. But by all accounts, an extremely dedicated kid when you meet him. And if they draft him, fans will realize this quickly, as will staff in Montreal. He's a very boxy, athletic build. That wide base, A-frame in his base, very, very square shoulders. When he was a kid in minor hockey and he would wear his suit after his minor hockey games, the very first thing I ever noticed about 15-year-old Shane Wright, 14-year-old Shane Wright, was just how square and boxy his shoulders were. So he's built like an athlete. I did a training session with him through BioSteel, who he also trains with in the summer. One summer where they invite journalists to run through a BioSteel workout and players participate. And the summer that I did it, it was Andrew Wiggins, Tyler Seguin, and Shane. And Shane is just an unbelievable athlete. His ability on long jump, on sprints, everything that we did on the dry land training, he was neck and neck at 16, 17 years old with Tyler Seguin and all of everything that we were doing. So a very natural, gifted athlete, another kid who surprised people with how well he performed at the combine in Kitchener, really, really stood out, was number one in the overall testing among the 40 CHL kids that were there, which I think everybody expected him to perform well, but maybe not be number one. So that piece of it's there. And he's just a very, very dedicated young man. There's no question about that. No taking that away. But as far as the personality goes, he's not PK Subban. He's not Trevor Zegras. He's not Jack Hughes. He's not one of those naturally outgoing personalities. So it'll be interesting if he does end up in Montreal to see how he handles all of the attention, because I don't think it comes easy to him.
Right. Well, that's, and you know, you mentioned McDavid. I think it's everything you just said would have been true of Connor McDavid in his draft year, and even in his first few years in Edmonton. And he's eventually learned, as he's gotten comfortable in a leadership role there, that he can assert himself and he can express his opinion. And he grew into that. It took him, I think, a lot of time, actually. So, I mean, it's hardly unprecedented for a player, you know, in that sphere of prospect to be that way. Because, and I think it's also natural in the sense that when you're so singularly focused on one thing, that's your comfort zone, is doing that one thing and being, you know, socially adept, I guess, or being comfortable with the other side of being a hockey player sometimes comes a little later. And Tavares is also a good example. So, I mean, you know, that's not overly shocking. And I agree that that interview with Gino Reda on TSN didn't suggest that, you know, it seemed pretty, it almost seemed premeditated, right? Like it's as if he walked into that interview knowing he was going to say that, and it was prepared. And that could be a strategy. That just could just be a draft year strategy. Like, and we'll see how that plays out in the interview sphere. But I want to get into this with you just because of the debate surrounding Shane Wright. You know, I've been watching a ton of his games. You know, I'm up to nine now. I don't know if that's a ton, but that's, you know, it's a decent sample of his game, of his late season games.
No question.
You know, their entire series against Oshawa, I still have to watch the North Bay series and a few of his regular season games. And I really find, I guess the one thing that jumps out to me, and I'll be writing a piece on this, by the way, for our listeners that you can expect probably later this week. But the one thing I found is that if you watch Shane Wright for one game, it's highly possible that he's not going to stand out, and that you'll be left wanting. Like if you go to the game specifically to go watch Shane Wright, you could watch an entire game and be like, he didn't really do a whole lot. But when you watch him over and over and over and over again, particularly the way I was, like consecutively, and you know, watching 3-4 games at a time, just his shifts, it's amazing how there's like a certain creeper effect of Shane Wright's game, because you watch it and then all of a sudden you realize, wow, I haven't seen that kid make a mistake yet. And like, wow, you know, he does, like he makes little plays that facilitate his team's game over and over and over again, and does them with great efficiency over and over and over again. And they don't necessarily directly lead to goals, but they lead to the process that leads to goals. And he does it so consistently. So I kind of get it when people are left a bit underwhelmed by him, because he's not a spectacular player. In fact, if you look through my notes, the word unspectacular appears a lot, but he's just incredibly efficient. And maybe he doesn't fit the box of what a number one overall pick should look like, but he's a hell of a player. Like, if you take all the other things away, if you take like the exceptional status and what he did as a 15-year-old and the number one overall pick, and you just look at him playing hockey, like that guy is going to be a very, very good NHL player, in my opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And even beyond all of the sort of, if there are big boxes you want a player to check and the small boxes you want a player to check, even beyond all the small boxes that he does check, I do think there are legit NHL caliber offensive tools in there as well. He can absolutely shoot the puck. He's got an NHL. Yeah. He's got an NHL release. That's not an issue. The skating has really improved. He's always had a very, as I mentioned, that A-frame, that very balanced, hard to knock off the puck, sort of sure on his feet style of skating. But I think he's increasingly developed his speed through the middle of the ice. He's increasingly more involved in transition. All of that is beginning to come. He's never going to be a Matt Barzal or a Dylan Larkin. He's not that kind of a skater, but he's a strong, powerful, forward pushing kind of style of skater. And then the big thing this year, I think he would tell you this if you were to ask him, but the big thing this year with his game is there has come more and more creativity. He made a number, especially in the second half of this season, made a number of kind of behind the back, below the goal line, hitting someone against the grain at the back post when they were expecting him to go for the wraparound, those kinds of plays that were less frequent in his outstanding rookie season. And I think they came at a little bit at the expense of his goal scoring, but that was also because he was playing with much better players this year. In his draft year, he really got hot, or in his post-draft OHL year, he really got hot on a line with Martin Kromiak and Zade Wisdom in the second half. But before that, and frankly all year, that Kingston team wasn't actually very good. That first line became a lot of fun for people to watch because Wisdom and Kromiak were also both going to be drafted players. But it wasn't a sort of exciting offensive team. And then this year, you look at the top nine that they've got in Kingston, and it's loaded, right? There are several drafted players. There are several players who can really shoot the puck. Our Curry can really, really shoot the puck. So there were just passing options for him. And naturally, I think everybody was expecting him to score 40 goals this year. And when that didn't happen, you ask questions. But ultimately, I think by and large, he made progress with in other areas of his offensive game. So the details are always going to be what impresses scouts. He's always below the puck. You almost never see him cheating out of his offensive zone. Even early on this year when the offense wasn't coming, he was supporting the play deep. Even at the World Juniors, when Cole Perfetti, his line mate, was racking up points, and you're wondering how, through two games, has Shane Wright not registered a point playing with Cole Perfetti? There he was, the lowest man in the defensive zone, often trailing the play into the offensive zone. And the result is just that some of the counting stats don't come maybe as naturally as they should with his skill level. So we'll see what that looks like at the NHL level. I'm not sure NHL scouts are as convinced as the public sphere seems to be that he's going to be this dominant two-way player, sort of Patrice Bergeron, Jonathan Toews type. And I tend to agree, actually. I don't think he's going to be a star defensive player, but he's not going to leave you wanting more off the puck. And then on the puck, you just hope that he can be a top offensive player. And I think there are signs there that he's capable of becoming that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We hear scouts talk about things like compete and heart, and I don't know if you see a real difference between those two words, but when it comes to Wright, you know, you'll hear some people say he's got great compete level, but I've also heard many instances where on certain nights people would say, well, he didn't seem too interested. So and I don't know if you put the playoffs in the balance in that, but where does he really stand? Where can you help set the record straight on that?
Yeah, there are definitely two pieces of that sort of competitive piece, I think, for people. I think when people talk about competitive, they think about how engaged is he in battles. Is he fighting and keeping his feet moving when he's lost a battle to try and re-win it? And sometimes there is, he does leave you wanting more on that front. Not that he's giving up on plays. I don't think anybody would say that Shainwright gives up on plays, but he doesn't appear to be, at least to the eye, he doesn't appear to be this sort of really fiery, competitive player at all times. Even this year with Connor Bedard just developed this real chip on his shoulder. Sometimes I actually think to his detriment, where he started taking slashing penalties and penalties that you don't want Connor Bedard taking, because he was trying so hard to finish every check and to show people that he was this feisty kid. And Shainwright, I don't think, feels like he needs to prove that. He's not going out there looking to mix it up and be involved after whistles. And you don't really see that fire from him on the ice, if you will. But I think people can confuse that for a lack of competitiveness at times as well. He's always in the right position. He's always above the puck. He's always, as I mentioned, swinging deep in the defensive zone to support the play below the goal line. And that, to me, is a huge signal of competitiveness, because the players who lack that are the players who are standing at the offensive blue line, waiting for the outlet pass, looking for the breakaway. Those are the players, to me, who truly lack competitiveness. And I think it shows how committed he is to winning, that he's consistently doing all of those things, even if he's not sort of throwing kid sticks over his head when he's getting underneath sticks on stick lifts, right? Like he's not that sort of powerful, I'm going to win this puck, I'm going to sort of really get in on your body and take the puck back kind of a player. Like it's just a little bit more subtle. I don't know. I have mixed feelings on the whole competitiveness thing around Shainwright, because I can see why people want him to be that more sort of scrappy player that he's not. But I do have a great appreciation for his commitment to the details, and Luca Caputi and all the guys in Kingston would reaffirm that without just trying to pump his tires in kind of a typical coach kind of a way. So I don't know. Mixed feelings for sure.
Yeah, well, I would take that even a step further, because, you know, those guys who will, you often hear scouts say, well, I'd like to see him like take over the game. You know, I'd like to see somewhat like, you know, kind of like Connor McDavid did in game 6 and 7 and of the LA series, where he just decided, we're not going to lose this series, and I'm going to take care of that. And
that was most noticeable off the puck, right? Where he's just hunting. That's not really what Shane does.
No. And to your point, you know, one thing I found about, like, in the games where you don't notice him as much, I think it would be natural for a kid like him in his draft year, slated to go number one, knowing all eyes are on him, to start, not necessarily cheating the game, but to start forcing things that aren't there. And one thing I think he does really well is to take what's given to him. I don't know. I can't say with great definitiveness, but from what I've seen of him, you know, you rarely see him force a zone entry. You know, he's often given the task of taking the puck through the neutral zone and making the decision at the blue line. And he almost always takes whatever's given to him, and it's almost always successful. But it from what I've seen, it rarely involves him carrying the puck over the blue line. It involves him sucking people to him, finding the open man, and entering the zone with control. And he does it with pretty remarkable efficiency. However, if you're a scout and you're like, wow, I really want to see this kid take over, you want to see him bull rush his way through a four-man front at the blue line and force his way to the net. Mm-hmm. You're not going to see that, because teams are not going to give him that, because he's clearly the best player on his team and they're not going to let him beat them. So he's just going to take what teams are – like, this is how I read it, is that he's just going to take what's being given to him in a given game situation, and not allow all those other factors, like how he's performing in that game or how many scouts are on hand or if there's an NHL GM in the stands. He's not going to let those factors detract from what's being presented to him in that game situation, which speaks to me to a pretty high level of intelligence, which I think is pretty obvious when you watch him play, but also just a level-headedness where he can just handle he can handle all the external factors and just focus on what the game is presenting to him. And I think that's a skill.
No question. And I think people also people are always looking for the hustle play, right? And I think if more often than not, it's that classic line that Chris Pronger said about energy conservation and yada, 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 right? Like it's more often than not, if you're in the right position, you don't have to be chasing guys down. There's actually another player on Kingston by the name of Paul Ludwinski, who's eligible for this year's draft and has made fans of a lot of scouts publicly in the public sphere and in the private sphere for just being the energizer bunny. And I've actually argued repeatedly with Paul and often with players like Paul that Ludwinski is a very inefficient player. He's chasing the game all the time and it looks like his feet are constantly moving and he's constantly battling and he's constantly in the mix and he's in the fight. And all of that is how he appears, but
he's playing catch up.
Yes. He's just running around the ice, chicken with his head cut off. He's not in the right positions. All of that becomes a part of it when you feel like you need to just be the hustle guy. And I just don't think Shane feels he needs to be that to be an effective player. And I think he's right. Like if you're in the right spots and you're making the right play more often than not, you're going to drive results. And I think that's just how he has developed his game.
This is not going to be a podcast strictly on Shane Wright. We're going to move on to other prospects in a little bit, but I wanted to ask you, because in the event that Shane Wright was drafted by the Canadians, there hasn't been a single forward drafted first overall who has not made the jump to the NHL at 18 since Eric Lindros, when he had his rift with the Quebec Nordiques. So every single one of them, when they were drafted first overall and they were forwards, they graduated to the NHL right away. So I was curious to ask you about this, knowing that Shane Wright missed a whole season of hockey last year. And also with the World Juniors being scheduled in August, which might shrink the resting time or the practice time or whatever or training, and precipitate the beginning of the season for guys who will play in that tournament, which you could think also will lead to them, if they graduate to the NHL, they might hit the wall just because they started competitive hockey in August. Do you think as though Shane Wright would be one guy that would benefit from going back to juniors, or he's got nothing left to prove and he should be in the NHL right away?
Well, it's a tricky one because I do think he has more to prove. I think everybody would like to see him put up 110 points instead of mid-90s, right? Ideally, that's what you're expecting out of a player who you take first overall. But in saying that, I think he's the kind of player who you just have to give a full opportunity to in camp and go from there. And you don't necessarily have to keep him in the NHL like you may have felt with previous first overall picks. But I'm also very confident in saying that I think Kent gets that. I think Kent and their entire management group in Montreal understands the process and understands what, especially through Kent's experience, understands what matters most, and what matters most is not how good Shane Wright is at 18, 19 years old. So it's a tricky thing. I think you give him every opportunity to make the team. And if he plays well enough in camp to make the team, he's on the team and he's on the team all year. But I'm also not opposed in Shane Wright's situation to him going back to Kingston. Now he may have something to say about that, but so did Cole Caulfield. Cole Caulfield wanted to turn pro a year earlier, and I think we all recognize that the right call was made in sending him back to college. So sometimes you just have to have a frank conversation with the player. And I know that Shane Wright doesn't, as much as he loves Kingston, I know that he doesn't want to go back to Kingston next year. But I do think that that has to be a real consideration for him, and it may be what's best for him. But again, at the same token, you give him every opportunity in camp and you take it from there. Obviously there's two World Juniors coming up in a 6-month period, one in August and another in December in Halifax. The August one's tricky for him because that's also typically the time of the year where players are, especially prospects, are getting into their city. They're doing development camps and prospect tournaments, and all of that sort of happens in late August, early September. So it will be interesting to see what the Montreal Canadiens decide to do with Shane. I think it's a foregone conclusion that Owen Power and Cole Perfetti, those types of guys, won't be back at the World Juniors, even though they were on the team last December, and even though Hockey Canada would love to have them back. But Shane's an interesting one because I think that'll be, I think that could be good for him to go there and to play back in the top six and to play better than he did in December and to really make a statement in August ahead of his NHL training camp. So I actually honestly believe that where it's maybe not in the best interest for a Cole Perfetti or an Owen Power, it probably is for Shane. So that tournament, if he is allowed to attend by Montreal, could be an interesting one for him and really set the stage for whether it is Kingston or whether it is Montreal.
Yeah, that's interesting. I could kind of relate to Shane Wright because I spent 3 years in Kingston in university and I didn't want to go back either. So I understand where he's coming from. But listen, I do want to move on a little bit and really kind of dig in on something you said earlier, which I think is really the most intriguing part of the Canadiens process over the next few weeks, is the two defensemen, is Nemitz and Jiříček. You know, I think there's obviously that top three, the top three forwards are kind of conceded as being maybe the top guys. But I mean, when you look, when you look at the Canadiens' needs, they definitely need a center, a top six center to complement Nick Suzuki. Is an A1 need, and it's sitting right there for them. But mm-hmm. you look at their pipeline, and you referenced it earlier, there's a lot of depth in the pipeline, but you look at the guys on defense, you know, whether it's Gouley or Barron or Harris, or there's tons of guys with NHL, really good NHL potential. None of them really scream top pairing defensemen, to me at least. So that's also a need in the pipeline, because currently, they don't have legitimate top pairing defensemen. Jeff Petrie could be that, but you know, and I'm not talking about the pipeline. I'm talking about the entire organization. So these two guys who seem, you know, by most accounts, somewhat interchangeable, or depending on what aspect of each of their games that you prefer. But what does seem clear is that they both have the potential to become legitimate top pairing defensemen. Do you think the Canadiens would be crazy to consider either one of them at number one?
Well, I think they have to consider it, but I do think it would be a surprise in both cases. I actually am partial to Simon Nemitz, the Slovakian defenseman, but the consensus among most NHL scouts is that David Jiříček, the Czech D, has higher upside. He's 6'3". He's got an absolute bomb from the point, and teams just see him as the sort of complete package, the complete sort of size, skill, defending, physicality package, whereas Nemitz is a more tactical, calculating kind of player. Jiříček's a more in-your-face kind of player. I'm a big fan of both. Both are top five, top six players in this draft without question. I've argued all year that Simon Nemitz should be in the conversation for first or second overall. The one thing that we can't forget here is that it's in Montreal. And I actually do think, because of who Shane Wright is and because of what the average hockey fan knows about Shane Wright, and because it's being held in Montreal, it would be a very, very difficult thing for it not to be Shane Wright. That doesn't mean that going another direction is the wrong direction to go, or that you should even be considering the fans, but it does feel like something that's going to be impossible for them to ignore. Trading back, which almost never happens regardless. So I always tell fans not even to think about it or not even to ask about it, because it's a borderline irrelevant hypothetical that we always talk about every year and then never actually transpires. But even trading back and not drafting first overall in front of those home fans would be just one of the craziest things to ever happen at the draft. So that setting, I think, does matter in this, and it would make taking a D or moving back to grab one of those D a very tricky thing. But still, because Shane Wright isn't Connor McDavid and isn't Austin Matthews, you have to at least go down that road and consider it and have it as an option on the table.
Well, if they consider that Shane Wright is the guy to pick, great. But I think that succumbing to public pressure because the draft is held in Montreal is a risky road. I mean, last time the draft was held in Montreal, Canadiens went down to draft a crowd pleaser in Louis LeBlanc, and look how it turned out. So I think that they need to figure out what's best for the organization and not be too concerned about what's going to be their reaction inside the building or within the fan base, because otherwise they did something that they might regret down the road.
The only thing yeah. I would add as far as the D goes is that I think the Seattle Kraken are all but guaranteed to take one of those kids at fourth. So if you don't want to, if in a very small scenario where they move back, if you want to make sure that you get your guy and that you don't risk losing one of those two, you're really only moving back to second or third overall, which means your trade partners are really only Arizona and New Jersey in that scenario, because Seattle is, after taking Matt Beniers last year, I would be shocked if Seattle doesn't take a D this year.
Just a side note regarding scouting defensemen. You were mentioning how Juracek has got a bomb of a shot at the blue line.
Yes.
And we read notes and comments about defensemen who can quarterback a power play and all that. But with the way power plays have evolved over time, and they're not what they used to be in 15 years ago, are these criteria as important as they used to be in terms of quarterbacking a power play and having a great shot from the point, knowing that those goals and the role of a defenseman on the power play is not necessarily as impactful as it was before?
Well, it's definitely been watered down, the value of that big point shot from the D, but it still does matter. It still does change when you've got a defenseman who can quarterback the power play, like players who can quarterback the power play but don't have the shot, and he's got that weapon. It does change the way that teams have to defend you. That's just the reality. It was absolutely true of Shea Weber and Zdeno Chara and guys who can really shoot it, that changed the way that those teams played their penalty kill versus Boston and Montreal, or not previously Nashville, relative to the way that they played their penalty kill against virtually every other team in the league. So it will change the way that teams defend Juracek, and maybe it opens up things for him as a quarterback that it wouldn't open up for a player like Simon Nemitz, who is an extremely proficient power play quarterback and kind of the more modern type, but doesn't have that shot. So I do think it's a feather in his cap. There's no question where most defenders who put up that sort of 40, 50 point first pairing level, most guys nowadays are only scoring 6 or 7 goals, and it's pretty rare to see a defender score 10 to 15 goals. I think the belief is that Juracek is going to be one of those guys who scores 10 to 15 goals a year from the back end. So that teams do still covet that, but I don't think it's the be all and end all. And I think I would actually argue there's maybe a case to be made that Simon Nemitz is actually the better power play quarterback because of the way he manages it and walks the line and some of the subtleties of his game and the finesse to his game that Juracek maybe lacks. So those two defenders are very different, very, very different players. And it will be revealing of where they go, just relative, for my purposes, relative to what the teams that draft them covet, right? It's going to be very revealing of the type of defenseman that those teams like.
Yeah, and that's... I think, and when you're talking about the shot on the power play, I do think more and more, I'm with you 100% that if you do have that bomb, it does impact how a penalty kill approaches your power play. But the more important skill, in my opinion, is a defenseman's ability to get shots through. And when you talk about walking the line for Nemitz, that's, to me, the number one skill of a defenseman on a power play is that ability to walk the line, create different shooting angles, and find holes in what's become 4 or 5 sets of legs between you and the net. That's a skill that teams should value more than someone who can shoot it through the net. And so, but yeah, I agree that this will be kind of, I guess, a referendum of how teams view things. But, I mentioned the Canadiens' need on defense, which is clear. But I think, every NHL team has a value chart, and that value chart starts at center for most teams. The Canadiens do have that hole I mentioned earlier. It's funny, Marc-Antoine and I were talking about this a few weeks ago, and I had mentioned that Slavkovsky, this was before the lottery, so if the Canadiens were picking second, let's say, I was making the argument for Slavkovsky because they have this hole all season long. They were playing Suzuki and Caulfield, and they had this revolving door of wingers on the other side that they couldn't fill that spot. I was like, wow, wouldn't this guy be perfect? Kind of a prototypical power winger, would fit well with those two guys. They should go get him. Marc-Antoine didn't agree. And I've come to sort of see his side of it in the sense that second center is probably more important to the Canadiens right now. It's probably harder to find. So I'd like to hear you about Logan Cooley, because I feel, and listen, I haven't dug in on him at all, but I feel like all the stuff we were saying about Shane Wright is kind of the opposite of Cooley's game. Is that fair to say? Like, he's just a more of a dynamic presence, but with certain holes in his game. Is that a fair assessment, or am I wrong?
I don't know. I think he's a very well-rounded player. I think Cooley is he's got that scrappiness that everybody wants Wright to have. He's a very sort of middle lane driven. I would argue he's a tremendous two-way center for his size. He's a little bit of a smaller kid, but physical after the whistle, has a little bit of a chip on his shoulder and a little bit of a mouth at times. Scrappy, just sort of really works hard. And is a better skater, I would say, than Shane Wright, even after Shane Wright showed so well at the combine in terms of the skating drills that they ran in Kitchener and all of that. But there is that creative flair that Shane Wright lacks as well, right? So mm-hmm. Logan doesn't have the 6'1" frame, but he's got some of that slippery, crafty on the puck, playmaking sense to him. When the puck's on his stick, he is the guy who's carrying it on entries, which we kind of talked about. Shane's the guy who passes it to his winger on entry at the offensive zone blue line. Logan's the guy who carries it and goes right into the heart of the ice and looks to make a play, or carries it through the heart of the ice and then cuts to the outside to make a play from the perimeter. So Logan's got a little bit more of a dynamic quality to him, a little bit more flair. He's a better puck carrier and distributor and kind of playmaker than Shane is, I would argue. And then off the puck, he's a more scrappy, competitive player, but that also comes with the smaller frame. It comes with, I would say, a lesser shot. So there are definitely differences to their games, but both are viewed as two-way centers. So I think that is a big deal, because oftentimes right. when you're talking about centers at the top of the draft, that's the quality that you're often missing at this age. And both of those kids already have that, but Logan just does it in a more sort of scrappy kind of a way. So, and then on the puck, he's definitely got a little bit more of a zest, a little bit more of a flair to his game than Shane does.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Last week on the French podcast, we were discussing not only, you know, those top prospects' potential, but also their probability of reaching their potential as something that's equally important to consider. Yeah. I think there's a clear understanding here that Shane Wright's floor is quite high and that he would have a very good chance of reaching that floor.
Yeah.
And that it's more in terms of ceiling and chances to reach their ultimate potential, that someone else could challenge him as number one. So how do you see the ceiling and the chance to hit their ceiling for the various prospects at the top of the board?
Well, it does kind of remind, and I know this will make Habs fans shudder, but it does kind of remind of the kind of Nico Hischier versus what Cale Makar and Elias Pettersson became. I think there are going to be players in this draft class who become challengers 5-10 years down the line in a redraft that become neck and neck with Shane. I think Logan Cooley is capable of becoming a 70-point NHL player, and that will automatically put him in the conversation with Shane. I think if one of Simon Nemitz or David Yurchek become a top pairing defenseman, that puts you in the conversation. And because Shane's not going to become McDavid and not going to become Matthews, he's not going to be able to separate himself from other players. But I don't think that necessarily makes him the wrong pick either. If if you're sure that he's going to become that guy, then you don't have to worry as much about the challengers, because at the end of the day, all three of those teams are going to be happy with the player that they picked. And the player that you picked is a 6'1" center. So on that piece of the puzzle, I think it makes a lot of sense to still take Shane. He's going to be, spoiler alert, number one on my final board. I think he's the best prospect in this draft class. And it does come down to that fact that you kind of hinted at, which is, even if Cooley reaches his ceiling and becomes as good as he's capable of being, I don't think it's like he's going to be blowing past Shane in a redraft, maybe in the way that a Pettersson and a Cale Makar have with Nico Hischier. I think Shane's a better prospect at this age than Nico was, but it does remind of that kind of safety. People felt really comfortable in Nico Hischier becoming a good NHL player, which he has become. And if Shane can become a better version of that and a better player than that, then you're not going to be disappointed. Just like, as much as other fans would probably prefer Cale Makar and Miro Heiskanen and Elias Pettersson, I think the New Jersey Devils are thrilled that they have Nico Hischier as a top six center for the rest of his career in New Jersey. So it's a tricky conversation to have, and that isn't meant to discount Shane. I think he's a better prospect, as I alluded to, but that is part of it. The cost certainty is part of the equation with Shane.
Yeah, and I think there's also a certain measure of kind of what you mentioned before, not necessarily the difficulty of not drafting Shane Wright in front of the Montreal fans, and demand for tickets for that draft is right now is through the roof. That's one factor, but it's also just the factor that if you're going to go against what is not the strongest consensus, but remains a consensus mm-hmm. among the scouting community that Shane Wright is the best prospect. If you're going to go against that, you better be pretty damn sure of what you're doing, especially if you're a brand new GM with a brand new vice president of hockey operations, who's leaning on a brand new, you know, co-director of scouting, if you will. I forget what Nick Bobrov's actual title is, but it's basically that. All these guys are coming into a situation where this is the beginning of their era. Mm-hmm. To start it out with a mistake would be disastrous, far less from like an immediate here and now public relations standpoint in terms of doing it in front of their own crowd. But, you know, 2-3 years from now, if you look back and say, wow, the first major thing they did was a royal screw up. Doesn't really look good on the, it's a risk. It's a risk that not many people would be willing to take. Listen, Scott, before we finish up with you, we did want to talk to you about the other end of the first round. The Canadians have the Calgary Flames first round pick, so it'll be towards the end of the first round. And just so people understand, even if the Flames were to lose to the Oilers in this round, they're still slotted as a division champion in the regular season. So they're still going to be towards the back end of the 20s.
Like 29.
Yeah, that's it. So there's not really that much at stake. You shouldn't be rooting for the Oilers so the Flames will have a better draft position, because it's really not going to affect it that much. So at the back end of the first round, the Canadians have 2 second-round picks, 3 third-round picks. They also have 2 first-round picks next year, the Florida pick in the Ben Chiarot robbery that they pulled off. So I'm just wondering, in their situation, I think we feel the Canadians are in a good position to take a big swing on a player that might miss, but if you hit it, it's going out of the park. Are there players at the end of the first round in light of all the other draft capital they have, and in light of all the kind of the hedging they can do with those other picks, is there one guy towards the end of the first round that you think the Canadians should be looking hard at as a potential home run swing?
There are really 2 kids that immediately come to mind. And I'm not just saying this because I've written features on both of them this year, but the 2 kids that I really like in that range that are going to be ranked sort of in the late teens, early 20s on my board, but are likely to be available 10 picks later in the late 20s, are twofold, 2 different positions as well. The first is David Goyette, who is a center with the Sudbury Wolves. He was by far the best player on a very young, exciting team in Sudbury that wasn't actually very good, but is expected to be a top team next year as they all grow together. And Goyette is a speedy, one of the very best skaters in the draft, a speedy, freakishly athletic sort of 5'10" center with lots of skill, who is just a transition monster in terms of creating off the rush and creating with his skating. Big fan, was the OHL's rookie of the year, leading scorer as a rookie, et cetera, et cetera. But because he's 5'10" and because he's coming off of a bit of a letdown performance at U18 Worlds, I think he's going to be available late first into the second round potentially. And I really do truly believe that he's got a ton of upside as a potential sort of second line player. So Goyette's a kid that I'm very, very excited about. Coincidentally, he actually trains in Montreal in the summer, runs in a sprinting club with Nick Makrizanaris, who's obviously a former Olympian. So right. the running has always come naturally to him. He's, as I mentioned, very sort of incredible athlete, used to do speed skating as a kid. And you can see that in his sort of long stride that he has. So brilliant skater and a ton of fun to watch. And then the other kid is a defenseman by the name of Lane Hutson, who was the number one D at the National Development Program this year, despite being he's listed now at kind of 5'8", 5'9", but being a very, very small player and very, very small defenseman. But he's the exception to the rule. I've argued all year, I think he's the exception to the rule. We still don't see defensemen that small in the NHL. Smallest defenseman in the league this year was Jared Spurgeon at 5'9". There are others. Obviously, we're seeing the success that Sam Girard is having in Colorado, scored last night for them. So there are others that are finding success, but I truly believe I'd stick my neck out on the line to say that Lane Hutson is going to be an NHL defenseman and a darn good one. Brilliant skater, incredibly crafty with the puck, one of the smartest players in this draft, is going to quarterback the power play and plays, because of his skating and how competitive and scrappy he is, plays a passable defensive game and was trusted to play huge minutes for them, not just offensively, but defensively on that top pairing with Ryan Chesley this year. So Hudson's a kid that late first round, I absolutely love. And I think he could make a GM look really, really smart.
Is there any point, year after year, it seems as though I hear people say, well, you get the first 20 picks and then it becomes a long second round. And as it's the same analysis, no matter the quality of the crop, it seems to be the same division that's made every year. But is there any point for the Canadians with a new GM who seems more open in trading up than Marc Bergevin was before? Now, the Canadians have 2 second round picks. Do you think that it's more likely to be a better move to try to move up and use one of those second round picks to end up probably closer to the late teens, early 20s, and you would be you would have access to a better type of prospects if you were to, you know, to draft around 18 or 19 and have, you know, guys, I don't know, a Connor Geeky, a Frank Nazar, Roger McGrorty, guys like that. Do you think that there's a separation that's really worth considering trading up this year?
Well, McGrorty's another kid that if I were to list a third kid who's actually might be available there, McGrorty's another kid that I would absolutely swing for the fences on in the sort of late 20s if he lingers. He's a kid who's a big, strong, athletic kid, one of the most muscular, sort of well-built kids that I've ever seen at this age, and has tons of skill, can absolutely rip the puck. A very, very smart, intelligent player, was the captain at the National Development Program. You guys, from a media perspective, will absolutely love him because he is an unbelievable talker and just has such life about him. But the skating is an issue. And I think because the skating is an issue, he's going to fall further than he should. So he's a kid I've been high on all year, a lot like Goyette and Hutson. So that's a player you may not even have to trade up for. But if you're looking to get outside of that sort of top 10, top 11 group, and you're looking to get into the Denton Matichuk, Cutter Gauthier, Kevin Korchinski, Marco Casper, that Connor Geeky, who you mentioned, Liam Ogren, if you're looking to get into that range, you're going to have to get into the teens. And there is definitely a difference between those 8 or 9 players that are likely to be picked in the 10 to 20 range than there is in the kids that you're going to get in the 20s. But I mean, my final board, which isn't out yet, that I'm staring at right now, it runs to 27 before a real drop-off. So I do believe that there are players comparable to the Korchinskis and the Matichuks and the Ogrins and the Cutter Gauthiers. I do think there are kids comparable to those kids that are going to be available even if they're not as sexy a name, I do think there will be kids comparable to them available in the 20s. So that doesn't mean you don't trade up and grab one of those kids who feels like a more sure thing in the teens. But I think there's going to be sneaky value in the first round if teams approach it right. So that I would probably be tempted just to sit put.
Man, I'm just looking at Lane Hudson's HockeyDB page.
Yeah.
And I'm sure this is actually off at this point, but he's listed at 148, which I would imagine is inaccurate at this point. But his HockeyDB photo is, he looks like he's 12, right? So, I mean, you would think, like, I've always pictured the scene in Moneyball where all the scouts are discussing the prospects and they're talking about how a guy's wife is ugly, he doesn't have any confidence, and all how this impacts his ability to hit and whatever. And I just think of Lane Hudson, a scout looking at him and being like, you know, can you even drive? Like, are you allowed to drive? Like, it's just, honestly, it looks like his grade six school photo in HockeyDB. It's quite
Where's
funny,
the babysitter?
But, yeah, that's yeah. it. So, but anyhow, I mean, you know, if he can play, he can play, right? So, I mean, that's,
Just for what it's worth, he did tell me he's 150 pounds when I was down there in November. So
there you go. So HockeyDB is off by 2 pounds. There you go. Yeah. Take that, HockeyDB. Yeah. Totally inaccurate, but yeah, that would be quite something. What's Quinn Hughes at? He's in the 160 range.
I looked all of these kids up as part of the piece. So I've pulled up my piece here. Spurgeon was the smallest and lightest at 166. So that's a 16 pound gap between where Lane is at. And I think Lane told me up front too, he struggles. He burns off weights. He's one of those natural athletes who just burns off weights so fast that he struggled at the program to really bulk up. So I'm not even sure he'll get there. Maybe he plays at 162, 163. But after that, the second lightest defenseman in the league this year. So Spurgeon was 166, Sam Girard's 170. And then after that, most of the 5'9" kids, even Quinn Hughes, Victor Mete, Torrey Krug, those are pretty thick kids now. They're all in the 180s. So it's really just Spurgeon and Girard as far as current NHL defensemen go that are in the sort of 160s, 170s range. And that's what Lane hopes to get to and eventually play at. So you're hoping that he can be a Spurgeon or a Girard, who are, let's be honest, fabulous, fabulous NHL players if he can be that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that, you know, I find this fascinating. And the Quinn Hughes thing really kind of cemented this, where I think there's been a shift in the NHL because of how many people were wrong about Quinn Hughes in his draft year, playing at the weight that he was at that age, projecting that he would not be able to survive in the NHL, let alone thrive the way he has ever since. That there is a definite a shift in viewpoint, but how significant is that? Is that shift significant enough that this kid could make an impression to be taken in the first round or even in the second round at that weight? I think would be really telling about where this league is going. Like, this is really a pseudo referendum on the future of the NHL with this kid. It's really fascinating to me, at least.
Definitely. And it's coming a year after Olin Zellweger, a sort of skinny 5'10" defenseman, was taken in the second round. And a year later is one of the best D prospects on the planet and would go in the top 20 in a redraft. Right. So there's also, I think in a lot of people's minds, Olin Zellweger has been a real talking point in the hockey world this year with how unbelievably dominant he was in the WHL this year. Like, he might've been the very best player in the WHL, or at least comparable to Connor Bedard and a couple of others. So Zellweger has turned some heads that way as well. And yeah, it's tricky because Lane's going to go in the second. If he doesn't go in the late first, he's going to go in the second. But I think teams don't want to get burned. They don't want to be talking about him like they're talking about Olin Zellweger a year from now if he goes to college and lights it up as a freshman in the NCAA. Right? It's just it's a tricky proposition with a kid like that because he is darn talented.
Hey, Scott, it was so nice having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for your insight and input. There's plenty more draft talk that we could have, but we'll let you off the hook for now. It's plenty of good material, I suppose, coming up from you on The Athletic in the next few weeks. Can you give us
I've got a few profiles I'm working on, one on Connor Geeky, one on Tristan Luno, who was the first overall pick into the QMJHL a couple of years ago, and another on Danny Jilkin. So those are the three stories I'm working on right now. And then it'll be full throttle after those three are done into mock drafts, my final draft ranking, which will be out the day after the combine, all of that. So really looking forward to getting into the big pieces once I'm done some of the storytelling.
Yeah, and awesome. I think it's going to be fascinating. I think this is a fascinating draft year. Obviously for people who are Canadiens fans, most of our listeners here, but I think just generally the level of, you know, from an outside perspective, someone who doesn't follow this year round, just seems like the variance this year is higher than most years. And so I think, you know, the work that you do and Corey Pronman and anyone, not only people at The Athletic, but anyone who really digs deep on this all year, your work is so valuable right now. And really helps fans understand what's a complicated process. So everyone should be looking out for Scott's work, Corey's work on The Athletic as well. And just being thankful that there are people like this exist, because yes. I appreciate it every year, because once I get out of NHL mode and into like, okay, draft prep mode, you can't just do it in a few weeks. You know, you need people like yourself, you need people like Corey, who devote themselves to it all year. And so our readers definitely benefit from that. So I encourage everyone listening right now to dive in on The Athletic on all the great stuff that's already there and the great stuff to come as well. So thank you, Scott.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. And can't wait to see you guys in Buffalo.
Yes, looking forward to it. All right. Take care, Scott.
All right, and thank you. That's it for The Athletic support for this week. So we'll be back next week with the French edition. And until then, we'll enjoy the weather, enjoy the playoffs. A lot of exciting hockey being played. So enjoy the Battle of Alberta and the Battle of Florida. So Arpin, till next time.
Be good, everyone. Bye-bye. Let it.